Good morning. The reading is from John chapter 11, verses 1 to 45. So, you know, just keep listening. Even though it's long, it's a good story. Now, a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, "Lord, the one you love is sick." When he heard this, Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. And then he said to his disciples, "Let's go to Judea." "But Rabbi," they said, "a short while ago the Jews there tried to stone you, and yet you're going back?" Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours of daylight? Anyone who walks in the daytime will not stumble, for they see by this world's light. It is when a person walks at night that they stumble, for they have no light." After he had said this, he went on to tell them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going there to wake him up." His disciples replied, "Lord, if he sleeps, he will get better." Jesus had been speaking of his death, but his disciples thought he meant natural sleep. So then he told them plainly, "Lazarus is dead, and for your sake I am glad I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him." Then Thomas, also known as Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, "Let us also go, that we may die with him." On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Now, Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. "Lord," said Martha to Jesus, "if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now, God will give you whatever you ask." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha answered, "I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day." But Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live, even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this?" "Yes, Lord," she replied. "I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who is to come into the world." After she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. "The teacher is here," she said, "and is asking for you." When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who had been with Mary in the house comforting her noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. "Where have you laid him?" he asked. "Come and see, Lord," they replied. Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. "Take away the stone," he said. "But Lord," said Martha, the sister of the dead man, "by this time there is a bad odor, for he's been there for 4 days." Then Jesus said, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me. When he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, take off the grave clothes and let him go. Therefore, many of the Jews who came to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did believed in him. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Kia ora tātou. Thank you for the reading. It's a long reading. I know that the readings in Lent have tended to be long over the last few weeks. Not sure if you've been to the central library here. There's a large green stone in the entrance, and you're invited to rub it when you enter. And there's a sense here in which, with these Lent readings, which come around every 3 years, the craggy story is in front of us, and we can just give it a bit of a polish, just encounter it. Take some of our edges off maybe as well. Okay. It's a long story. I need to ask your forbearance because it may be somewhat of a long sermon as well. We'll see how we go. But so at the very start of Lent, I attended an Ash Wednesday service for the first time. It was held in this very building, and it culminated with us being invited to line up and approach the front, which was there for the service. But unlike every other time that I've been invited to line up here, which is for communion, this time when I got to the front, those of you who've been to the service will know this experience, I was not given communion, of course, but marked with the sign of the cross, with a dark black pigment made from the ashes of the crosses from last year's Palm Sunday. And the minister, who in this case was Sue Fordyce, followed up my anointing with the liturgical response, Philip, remember that you are dust, and to dust you will return. And then we left. The shadow of death hovers over us throughout the period of Lent. That's something I don't really like to talk about much. I suspect most of you don't either. But this year I have felt more intensely than usual that one role of Lent for us is to provide us with a means of grappling with difficult and distressing aspects of life that we aren't spared from just because we have a faith. When I told my father that I was preaching on this passage, the first thing he said, without any, you know, great emotion or rancor, was that this is the passage the minister preached on at my mother's funeral. I don't remember this because I'd only turned 3 a few weeks earlier. She died of cancer, leaving my dad and me and my younger brother. This is her Bible. I don't tell you this to say I have some kind of special insight into loss. I have no doubt that the majority of you here will have experienced your own wrenching losses. The reason I raise this is just because I want to be up front and say, it's given me a lifelong suspicion of answers that seem too easy, or have too little regard for this life as a gift of God, or have too little concern for those who do grieve. If we could just have the first slide, thank you. Our reading today gives us a detailed and intimate account of God's response to our mortal condition and the pain of loss we all face from time to time. This is the 4th week that we've spent in John's Gospel, so we're in the habit of immersing ourselves in stories of Jesus' encounters with all kinds of people with all kinds of needs. Theologian Alan Culpepper says of John's Gospel that rather than coming to it and finding a set of theological propositions, we participate in a revelatory process as we read it. In other words, our reading today and over the last few weeks doesn't present us with a series of bullet points, right? But we're given meaning that emerges through our unfolding of the story. So we'll get underway now by setting the scene. In the previous chapter, we learn that Jesus and his disciples have fled from Jerusalem after an altercation at the temple. It's serious enough that they've crossed the Jordan River gone into the home territory of John the Baptist. Presumably, they went through Bethany on the way out of Jerusalem. And they would have there told Mary, Martha, and Lazarus of their plans, which is how the women knew where to send a messenger, right? That flying visit would also mean Mary and Martha would have a rough idea about how long it would take Jesus to arrive if he dropped everything and left immediately. Before we get to that, we can note the proximity of Bethany to Jerusalem meant that returning there so soon after they were almost stoned to death involved considerable personal danger for the disciples and Jesus. Indeed, although they will survive this journey, Jesus' actions when he gets to Bethany will so provoke the religious leaders that he decides, as it will say then in chapter 11, that he can no longer move about publicly among the people of Judea. At the start of our passage, that's all in the future, of course. But that genuine sense of danger leads to one of the disciples' all-time greatest one-liners. In verse 16, because when Jesus tells them they're going to go back across the Jordan to a village in the shadow of Jerusalem to visit a man who's already dead, Thomas comments, "Come along, we might as well die with him." Okay, the next slide, thanks. Prior to that decision to leave for Bethany, however, Jesus had made another decision, which was not to leave. If we're tempted to zoom through to a happy ending, verses 5 to 7 are the first speed bump that we're going to hit, suggesting we better slow down and start paying attention. Where we read, "Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So, when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. We know this. And then he said to his disciples, "Let us go back to Judea." And we could, of course, I think, you know, read this as a kind of practical acknowledgement, perhaps. 2 days was as soon as Jesus could hit the road again. There may well have been other things going on, preparations need to be made and so on. But the way that it's phrased makes it really hard to shake the idea that a 2-day delay is anything other than a deliberate choice, a withholding of help for those Jesus loved, and that it's done in the knowledge that it will lead to death and suffering. For those of us who believe that there's something more to existence than just randomness, and that there's a loving God attending to our lives, this is incredibly confronting. Because it's all very well to say in the abstract, God can't save everyone from every danger. It's all very well to say that he can't play favourites. But in the specific case of peril for me, or for someone that I love, seems entirely reasonable to me to ask if our faithfulness is counted for nothing at all, right? To ask if God really does love us. I'll try and come back to this a little bit at the end. But before we get to there, we need to follow our story deeper into that experience of sorrow and loss. By the time Jesus and his disciples arrive in Bethany, Lazarus has, of course, been dead for 4 days. From what we know of Jewish burial customs, during that time, those 4 days, Martha and Mary would have had a whole lot to deal with. In that first 24 hours after Lazarus passed away, they would have prepared his body, they would prepare his funeral shroud. They may well have been the ones to wash and wrap his body. They would then have sat with Lazarus until the point of his burial. Then they would have been at the front of the procession, lamenting and wailing as he was carried to the family tomb. After the ceremony at the tomb, they would have returned to their home, and there they would have been based for 7 days while they were visited by mourners who would be comforting them and supporting them. And it was, of course, in the very middle of that 7-day mourning period when Jesus and the crew turn up. We have the next slide. We'll leave that slide on, sorry. With their arrival at Bethany, the mood of the story does completely change. Now, before now, I think, the tone of the initial discussion between Jesus and the disciples has been somewhat familiar to us. Jesus says something, disciples miss the point, business as usual, right? We've heard the story before. Right? But whatever hope Martha and Mary may have had that things could work out differently has been extinguished, right? As a result, they have entered a raw space of emotion, right, of sorrow. And, you know, in a way, as we read the story, we are, you know, intruding on that grief, right? We don't know them. And yet here we are witnessing them at their worst moment. Although Mary and Martha come out to meet Jesus individually, they both say that same thing, right? Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And what they're asking is the kind of question we all might ask at such a time. If you are so powerful, and if you say that you love us, why didn't you do something to stop this terrible thing happening? Martha follows up, and she says, but I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. I don't think when she says that, she's saying that she expects her brother will be brought back to life. It's inconceivable to her, of course. But what she's saying, I think, is even though she feels massively let down, she still retains her conviction somehow that Jesus has some kind of unique connection to God. Even now, despite this, God will give you whatever you ask. Mary's follow-up is simply to break into tears. If you really love us, why didn't you do something? We can learn something about the life of faith from the sisters in this moment. It seems to me that it's that becoming a follower of Christ doesn't just make things all neat and tidy, doesn't make all the rough edges of existence go away. More than this, though, I think we're learning that it's not only allowed, but may even be right that we confront God when things completely fall apart. We're going to switch now our focus from Mary and Martha to Jesus and look at his response to them. What I think is interesting here, not only what Jesus does, but also what he doesn't do. Let's refer back to what he said to the disciples, way back across the Jordan River when they first get the message, right? Messenger arrives, delivers the news about Lazarus, he's sick. Jesus' response in verse 4, this sickness will not end in death. No, it's for God's glory, so God's Son may be glorified through it. And it's quite similar to what he said earlier after the disciples asked him way back in chapter 9 about whether a sin caused a man's blindness, which we've heard preached on quite recently, right? Neither this man nor his parents sinned, he answered, but this happened so the works of God may be displayed in him. When I read these exchanges, I'm not hearing Jesus saying God caused the thing to happen. But I think it's really hard to fully grasp it. What I do hear, at least, is a promise that somehow, in the midst of a terribly broken situation, God will be present. And we'll also come back to this later. But what I want to sort of just make the point about right now is that at the stage in the story where Jesus encounters Martha and Mary face to face, he doesn't say that thing. It's all for God's glory. Didn't say any of that. We'll get to what he says in a minute. But what I want to stress first is that he has this visible, strong emotion. Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping. He was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Where have you laid him, he asked. Come and see, Lord, they replied. And the famous verse, Jesus wept. And then Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. And what strikes me here, right, is that Jesus' emotional response occurs even though he's already certain that this is for God's glory and apparently in the knowledge of what he's about to do to raise the dead man. Even though he knows these things, he is still deeply moved. Moved in spirit and troubled, and he is weeping. Some translations, New Living Translation is one of them, will say for this verse, instead of deeply moved, they'll say he's angry. Part of this may well be for that general state of the human condition, but we can't forget the fact that these are people Jesus loved, and I don't think we can overlook his basic compassion for them either. And I also think, for what it's worth, that he did feel his own sense of loss. So if we can learn something about the nature of God from these scenes, it seems to me profoundly important that Jesus is moved and upset and perhaps even made angry by the loss experienced by everyday people. Go to the next slide. So now I want to turn to his words. In particular, that great I am statement, verses 25 and 26. Jesus responds to Martha, "I'm the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live, even though they die, and whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this?" There are a couple of words here that go off like flashing lights. One of those is believe. The other is life or live. Right? And in a way, we shouldn't be surprised by this. Because in John's gospel, he uses the word life about twice as often as any other gospel writer. And he uses the word believe more than all the other gospel writers combined. Those are like key words for John. Okay, live or life, believe. What I want to highlight here is in these first sentence especially, is that resurrection and life are so clearly linked, but they're still separate concepts, right? Jesus could have just said, if he wanted to, "I'm the resurrection." Case closed, right? What is this life he's also speaking of? You know, resurrection looks to the future, right? The life Jesus is promising is in the here and in the now. It's a quality of life. It's a fullness of life. It's a depth of life brought about by entering through belief in Jesus into relationship with God. And to make a bit more sense of what Jesus is doing and saying here, I've also found it useful to look back to John 6, immediately following the miracles of feeding the 5,000 and the walking on the water. It's a banger chapter, right? Verses 28 and 29, disciples are asking, "What must we do to do the works God requires?" And Jesus' response is this: the work of God is this, to believe in the one he has sent. That's all God's requiring. Sounds simple. But yet, when we look at our passage today, we can see why he calls it work. Because for Martha and Mary, in the jaws of their loss, I think nothing would seem harder, or less obvious, or maybe less reliable than that belief. And so as a result, when we hear Jesus calling for Lazarus and see him emerge from the tomb, we need to remember that this is a demonstration not only of the power of future resurrection, but a demonstration of the power of life in the here and the now. If we can learn something about the life that Jesus speaks of from this scene, I think it lies in that curious fact that he's not talking in any of this about the belief of Lazarus. That is, the emphasis of the story isn't on how Lazarus has achieved a certain level of belief, therefore he deserves to get raised from the dead, right? He's kind of secondary. It's Martha who's asked whether she believes. It's the disciples who promise that they will see God's glory if they believe. It's absolutely wonderful for Lazarus that he does rise, of course, and that gives us a future hope. All of us a future hope. But what his raising is signifying as well is the life that Jesus is bringing to Mary and Martha, which is unexpected renewal and restoration for them in the here and the now. Okay. So for the next slide, please. So what can we start to take from this very particular story into our own lives? I started by quoting that theologian Alan Culpepper and his claim that when we encounter John's gospel, we engage in this kind of revelatory process through reading it. The meaning unfolds. So in that spirit, I think that how we read this story has a real impact on how we understand the life of faith, especially the bleakest moments that we will encounter from time to time. During Lent, I've been thinking about what death means and what mourning or grieving means. I keep coming back to the way that death severs the individual from the community of the living and marks the end of any future for them. I've also been reflecting that mourning or grieving for the individual also feels like you're separated from the community. And you also feel in that state as if you have no future. And from that, I've kind of been reflecting on the way that there are all manner of experiences in our lives that have these kind of qualities that reach their fullest intensity in death itself and in mourning for the dead. Let's call them Lent experiences. Not because they happen during Lent, but because they suddenly make us feel that we are just dust. Just this recently, in the last week or so, our brother David Rowe, who was minister here, now back in England, shared in his podcast some reflections on retirement. I'll just read a brief excerpt from his words. He says, "So retirement, suddenly stopping what I've loved doing for 50 years, sharing the love of God with others through drama, preaching, leading, discussions and storytelling, struggling to come to terms with letting that go has led to some grief. I'm not saying this for special sympathy," he says. "This is a reality for lots of people in retirement. There is, of course, a peace in laying all that down. It was a beautiful season, but it is a battle resisting the thought that I am a once was, that there is no future. I can feel that I am disappearing," he writes, "and frankly, sometimes you want to disappear." David's account of retirement conveys to me, at least, a sense both of the death of what once was and a grieving over that. Both things, death and the mourning. And there are so many other kinds of Lent experiences in life that have that mixed quality of being something really terminal for us that we also grieve for. It might be your employer tells you you are redundant. It might be failing an exam, dropped from a team. Might be an excruciating relationship or a divorce, the death of a close friend or relation, conviction for a crime, bankruptcy, all kinds of things. None of these things any of us would seek out. But I'm pretty sure everyone here will have experienced something of this kind that fits this kind of description. Sometime in the past, it's pretty likely most of us will experience something of that kind of experience sometime in our futures. For me, if I can be personal, I can recall a time in my life, a few years ago now, when I was so overwhelmed by things and was so aware of the mess I'd made of all kinds of things. As I was cycling home from work, I got to the roundabout nearest to my home. I found I was thinking, things would be a lot better for everyone if I got hit by a car right now. That was a Lent experience for me. I think I was in the tomb. What does any of this have to do with how we read the story of Lazarus and his sisters? Could I have the next slide, please? Two kind of moves to make as we start to wrap things up. First of all, I think there's a way I don't think we should read the story. And that is to read it as a kind of a linear experience, in a kind of a straight line where it's just about getting to that happy ending, right? Seeing that happy ending as justifying all the misery that went before, right? So that we can effectively skip over or forget the bad bits before then. I'm really uncomfortable with that approach. If it implies that God is only present in our lives when things are going well, or worse, if it makes us think that it's God's desire for terrible things to happen to us. I'm uncomfortable because it's too easy to look past Lent, perhaps. But there has to be hope, right? So is there a different way we could maybe think of the story, take away from it? And I'll have the last slide. As I've wrestled with this passage, I've increasingly come to feel it's telling us two things at once about God's presence in these Lent experiences that come our way. Two things at once. The first thing is that Jesus stands alongside us when, for whatever reason, we feel ourselves outside the community of the living and that we have no future. One of the Good Friday readings from Isaiah 53, we'll encounter if we go to the service on Good Friday in a few weeks, describes the servant as a man of sorrows acquainted with deepest grief. Jesus is alongside us in that tomb, and he's alongside us as we grieve outside it. And I'm convinced that his patience is such that he stands there alongside us for as long as that mourning period needs to last. We may not feel it, but we can know it, because when Jesus received the message telling him that Lazarus was sick, he didn't send a message back asking what the belief levels in Bethany were before deciding whether or not to send, you know, to send help, right? He came anyway. And then when he got here, there, he wept. And I think we can take immense reassurance from that. We can also take immense reassurance from the second thing Jesus does at one and the same time, which is that he unceasingly calls the dead to life. For good reason, our attention is drawn to that tomb, right? It's spectacular. The stone is rolled away, Jesus calling in a loud voice, Lazarus to come out. He emerges, unwrap him, restore him. Tremendous. But I just also want to draw our eyes just to what happened just before then. Jesus' interaction with Mary and Martha. Remember, he's arrived in the middle of their mourning period, 4 days into seven. And yes, he's weeping, he's mourning with them. But even as he did so, remember, he called them out of the house of mourning. The custom would be for him to go in, but he calls them out, and he meets them and mourns with them. But he's called them out of the house of mourning. He's the man of sorrows who also impels us to life. This passage doesn't, I think, tell us what kind of life we're being called back into in the midst of our own Lent experiences, or how it will come about. And we can't read it as a promise things will always be put back the way that they were. But we're called from our mourning, and we're called from our tombs, right? The Old Testament reading for today is from Ezekiel chapter 37, when Ezekiel is taken by the Lord in a vision into the Valley of Bones. And the Lord asks Ezekiel, "Son of man, can these bones live?" Ezekiel's answer is, "Sovereign Lord, you alone know." The answer that Ezekiel finds, the answer that we know from our story, is yes. God wills us to life in the here and the now, and with the future hope of resurrection to come. If you'll permit me to read just one line from my mother's Bible to wrap up. It's from the Gospel of Matthew, not John, but Matthew. Just chapter 22, part of verse 32. One of these endless debates. The religious leaders. Jesus reminds them all, and he reminds us, he is not God of the dead, but of the living. The only work asked of us is that we believe.